Hi, this is a Life of Learning podcast. We hope you enjoy this episode. Hi everyone. Today we have a special guest, Amari. I met Amari at a spoken word open mic workshop. Their spoken word piece that Amari did at the beginning of the open mic session really blew me away. I really identified with a lot of the things that Amari came up with. So I thought it'd be great to have Amari come on the podcast as a special guest. Amari, thank you for coming onto the podcast.
No worries.
Good stuff. Talk about your sort of like your origin story, you know, your sort of like background, and then what really got you into spoken word.
I'm born and raised in London and went through the whole UK school system. I actually really enjoyed poetry when I was in school, but I've been writing since I was really, really young. And through all of that, it's kind of like been the one way in which I have been able to communicate is through poetry. So when I was about 20 to 21 after university, I started going to open mics and performing some of my poems for the first time, which was just a really nice experience to feel like I would like finally been heard.
Yeah, I must admit, I mean, it's just the first time I've done spoken mic this year, so I'm very, very, very new to it. But I've been journaling, you know, since I was a teenager, and I've written a lot of personal stuff and stuff like that. But I think what you just said about open mic is, you know, even though you're, you know, writing stuff, it's nice to be able to share it with everyone.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Okay. So what? I mean, the open mic piece that you did at the Dugdale Centre a few weeks ago, as I said, I was really impressed, and I really found that piece so moving. Do you remember the piece that you said a couple of weeks ago? Do you remember it?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Can you just, explain the origins of that and, you know, what made you come up with that one? Because I thought that was really powerful.
So that was written after a personal independence payment assessment, where I'd kind of scored zero on every single category because they said that like it was a mental health condition, not autism, not ADHD, and therefore like I should just try harder and that they weren't going to award any support. And when I was in that appointment, they listed off OCD at 7, depression at 11, well, like not quite like that, but it was the years. So it was like 2003, 2007, and so like when I listened and I thought about my ages, I kind of started to formulate a poem of like all of these diagnoses that they've given me and still no support, but I know myself and I know my brain, and if it was a different story written down on those pieces of paper, you would look at me differently. And I think that was kind of what inspired me to write it down, was the feeling that I got after that appointment of feeling like you're just so wrong.
Yeah. And I mean, that's quite vulnerable to come up with a piece like that. But I think open word is kind of like that anyway, from what I'm feeling anyway, every time I go to these open mic sessions.
Yeah.
People open up a lot more than I think they would normally.
That's very true.
Yeah. So with regards to, you know, what you mentioned, the autism and, you know, the other, so what else did you say? So it was autism and what else? Oh, did you say OCD? Did you say
ADHD?
ADHD, yeah. Got it.
Was diagnosed with OCD, then depression, then social anxiety disorder, and then borderline personality disorder. And like after my experience of working in an autism school and training to be a teacher and like learning more and more about autism and ADHD and identifying my needs and how to meet those needs for like the first time in my life, I feel like none of these labels that I've been assigned have really truly like explained what's been going on underneath. Like it might be the presentation, but it's not the full story.
And in terms of sort of like, because you must get obviously must be angry and frustrated at least. Do you think that sometimes comes out in your spoken word?
Yeah, definitely. I think people say that I'm very in control of my anger on a day to day, which has taken like a lot of work. But I think writing is a big part of that. Like having a place to just let it out means that I can control my meltdowns a little bit easier and things like that, because I have a space to like be able to articulate my thoughts.
Yeah, and have you, I mean, I can't be the only person that's sort of like come up and I really identified with some of the things you've said. Do you get that a lot or not?
Yeah, every time I perform.
Good. And that must make you feel really good that people get you and there are people out there that benefit from some of your words.
Definitely, it's a good feeling, and I think it's amazing to know that like you bring other people to just like be the same amount of vulnerable and meet you where you're at, because like the idea of, especially when I kind of get up and I go first and stuff, the idea of me being so vulnerable is that it allows others to do the same. And I think we've all got stories to tell, so.
Okay, so that's the reason why you go up first, just to sort of like you're like the warm up, you're like the warm
Sometimes when I'm in a good mood, I go first, yeah.
act. Okay, got it. Yeah, because I tell you what, that was obviously it was my first open mic of spoken word, and you came up, and I'd have to say you're the only one that I remember, and you were first up, and I think there must have been about I don't know 15 other acts after that, but you were the first, you were the one that I remember the most, and I thought, oh no, I've got to speak to Mari after,
Yeah.
and yeah, at least see if we can try and get her to come on, sorry, to get you to come onto the podcast. So yeah, and is this something that you do a lot then, in terms of open mics and stuff?
Yeah, I suppose like once a week or so, sometimes I drop off a little bit, come back to it. It just depends on what's going on. And I've got a lot of friends that are poets, so I try and support at all of their events and things like that, which has been really nice. Like it's just kind of something that's like aside from work or health or like, routine things that I have to do. It's just like out of the norm. And it is a bit, I think it's a bit challenging for me at times, and I don't always go to open mics, but when I do enjoy it, like I really, really enjoy it. So then I'll go to another one after that.
Yeah, I must admit it's addictive, because when we did, we do the workshops before the open mic, and when they said, do free write and then, think of a topic that you want to write and stuff like that. That first time I went, between sort of like the first session and the second session, so it was a month apart, all I was doing was just thinking of things to write. My head was sort of thinking, oh, I could talk about this subject, I could talk about this, I could talk about this, and I'll be writing words and sentences and see if I can group them together and stuff like that. Is that something that you do as well, or is it just me?
Sometimes I do love workshops a lot. I feel like they unlock a lot of things, because I do struggle with writer's block, and like one of the things with ADHD is that you benefit from body doubling, which is like the concept of working alongside other people. So I think workshops are really productive for me in terms of being able to like unlock stuff and find things that I do really want to write about. And it's nice because you kind of leave workshops with like loads of half finished things. So you've got a lot to go away and pick apart, which has always been like a benefit for me. So I love workshops as much as I love open mics, really.
Yeah. And but one thing that I found as well, the diversity of people at these workshops. Can you just tell people how you feel about the diversity of people at these workshops?
Yeah, I mean, poetry is not really like targeted at anyone, I guess. It's sort of like any human being can be a poet or is a poet. Like you just put words together. And I think even the way in which I formed kind of poetry out of Makaton really showed me, because I wasn't directly signing all the words I was saying, but I was telling a story with all of that Makaton that someone who couldn't understand any of my words would still be able to follow the story. So I think like realizing that everything is an art form, every kind of communication is an art form, and I think like I've seen amazing things recently, deaf poets and like all kinds of communication of different languages as well and different. So I think generally speaking, poetry is something that's hugely diverse, and it's something that I've always encountered with, like, me myself. I have a poem called Diverse History, and like, I'm African, Asian, and European, so like, I have such a mix anyway. But I think I've really found like a nice kind of place in poetry where I can express all of my identities.
Ah, Tilda, that was well said. Can you mention, you mentioned Makaton. Can you just explain to sort of that listeners what Makaton is? Am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah, so Makaton is it's a form of sign language used for communication, but it doesn't have every single word like British sign language would. So Makaton misses out words like to, the, and it just kind of has keyword, it's keyword communication. And they use it in early years, they use it with autism, and it's really effective for people who have delayed speech because a lot of the signs kind of imitate the sounds and things like that. So it can really help to like teach young people how to speak and to like give autonomy as well to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to communicate effectively. And it's a beautiful, I've been using it for about 5 or 6 years now, and it's just a beautiful form of communication because it is incredibly simplistic, but that's what makes it so effective, where British Sign Language kind of mirrors our everyday language and can go as complex as our conversation right now, which Makaton wouldn't be able to do.
Okay, yeah, it's interesting you should say that it misses out the words to, at, and the, because I was recently diagnosed with dyslexia, and I knew I had dyslexia all my life, but I've actually got the diagnosis, and the words to, at, and the are the words that I regularly miss out when I'm writing
Oh,
something.
really?
Yeah, it really is. So when you said that, I thought, oh wow, okay. Yeah. So in fact, in terms of diagnosis, how do you feel about in terms of just people generally getting diagnosed and the support? What's your feelings on that? And what, yeah.
I think the best way to articulate the answer to that question would be a quote. And the quote is like, being undiagnosed is like playing a video game where the level is set to hard, and like, diagnosis is the knowledge that the game is set on hard when you didn't realize your whole life. And like, then you have the strategies to play the game better. So I think that that's kind of what diagnosis is more about, and self-diagnosis is really, really accepted in the autistic community. So from that point on, for me, really, I managed to like become the person I am, really, in terms of strategies and regulation and everything that came afterwards. So I think diagnosis or self-diagnosis is basically like an entry route to more information and more strategies that help you. So in the long term, it's like, you might not need a label necessarily, but I think you do need awareness or knowledge that something is going on, because otherwise you're so blindsided, like constantly masking and constantly trying to get through life thinking you're the one that's in the wrong, when actually like, your life and your perception of life is completely different to everyone around you.
Yeah, and that's what you mentioned something there, masking. Can you just explain to my listeners what that means?
Masking is what neurodivergent people do to appear more neurotypical. So masking is seen as a bad thing, has long-term negative effects on mental health, which is what studies show over like a 20 to 25 year period. And masking is more common in females, which is why like, the autism diagnosis rate is 3 boys to 1 girl. So a lot of females will not want to kind of get picked on and outed as being different, and have more of a desire socially to fit in, which is why they try to appear more neurotypical and mask. And boys are often in like early childhood development quite headstrong and independent, and get noticed more for ADHD and autism.
Yeah, no, I have heard that, and obviously masking, like you said, is it's long-term effects on mental health, and it must be very, very what's it called? What's the word? Tiring. Must take a lot of effort.
Yeah, definitely. Because, for example, like spending a whole day at work, for me, masking can often mean I come home and come like straight in the door and have a meltdown, just because it's been incredibly overwhelming to have to force like one social interaction after another without any kind of breathing space in between.
Is there any improvement in the diagnosis of females in terms of ADHD and
I think
autism?
the research and the awareness on masking has definitely kind of encouraged the diagnosis rate to be a bit more balanced out in terms of changing diagnostic criteria to include females and masking. Like, they have done a lot of work, but I wouldn't say in my lifetime it's likely to be 1 to 1 because I think there's still a long way to go. Like, in the 1930s, people believed that autism could only like you could only be autistic if you were male, so it's not necessarily like that everyone in the world has really come around to understand it. So I think there's still a long way to go, but definitely in like the UK, the USA, Canada, and Australia, they've incorporated how it presents differently in females.
In terms of that, are you sort of like doing something yourself to sort of like bring awareness? Because obviously, with your spoken word, for me, that obviously brings awareness to someone like me and to other people that are there. Is that one of the ways that you're trying to sort of like, are you looking to sort of like, I don't know, help with that?
Yeah, I mean, definitely to help people. Like, I speak to a lot of people who have been misdiagnosed with bipolar or like other conditions as well, and then had a late diagnosis of autism. And I think the adult community of people who are late diagnosed, I mean, even in the 90s, it wasn't believed to be a genetic condition. So everyone was quite taboo about the idea that your child could be autistic because it had something to do with like your parenting style. So things have come quite a long way, in terms of like a lot of that generation that grew up in the 80s, 90s have basically had late ad adult diagnoses. So I think there's a lot of change happening at the moment, and I think that adult community is massively advocating for like the future generations to come. So we are learning more and more every day, but it's definitely a journey in itself. And like, as every autistic person will tell you, like, society, at least in this country, in the Western world, is definitely not built for us.
And then they talk about the difference between sort of like linear and non-linear thinking and stuff like that. And but they are saying that neurodiverse people now are something that companies are trying to look for because it's just the way we think. We think differently. We think out of the box. We're, there's a lot of qualities that we have, and there's certain things that we're not going to be good at, but there's certain things that we're very, very good at.
Yeah, for sure. I can resonate with that.
Yeah. So with in your work, you teach children, or sorry, you teach children with
Yeah,
neurodiversity, or
I'm
you're in that space?
a history teacher, secondary school. So I'm also training to be a SENCO, and I work with special educational needs and mainstream. So I do both. I have a lot of exposure to both every single day, and know a lot of like the theory as well behind, which has been really helpful, I think, for me to apply and understand my life better along learning. And every kind of child is almost a additional case study that you can say, like, I've learned something each time. So
I've got two questions then on that. In terms of your teacher training and stuff like that, with your, with your additional needs, if I can call it that, did you get support?
yeah, I did. So I had disability student allowance, which was kind of why I thought I could go for a personal independence payment assessment. And I do have an access to work grant, which helps me to stay in work and gives me an ADHD life coach and things like that. So I do have that kind of, especially with the pre-diagnosis and the existing diagnoses that I have, like, I have access to support. It's just not necessarily been the exact right specialized support that was needed due to the whole journey that I've been on.
Okay, well, that's good to hear, because I know back in the day, we wouldn't have got anything.
Yeah, no, I think university and the shortage of teachers and how, like you said, with what the studies are showing, how great neurodiverse teachers are because they connect with the neurodiverse children in the classroom and can help to obviously change education to work for these children. So I think definitely, like, they wanted to support me with teacher training, but I don't think that would be necessarily true if I'd had something different that I'd wanted to do.
Yeah, sure. You might as well use it to your advantage, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And the second thing is, when you're in a class or when you're in any environment, do you think that you can spot someone that's autistic or someone sort of like neurodiverse?
It's a funny question because I do have a high neurodiversity radar. My friends around me are pretty much all neurodiverse, and the way in which I met them was that I identified their neurodiversity and my brain detected them as a safe person and gravitated towards them. So I do definitely have a radar. I wouldn't say it's perfect, but there's definitely like a sixth sense about it, which is what helps me to be so good at my job, because Senkos obviously do a lot of identification. And I think it's funny when people kind of used to call me the autism whisperer for years when I was working in an autism school and had no idea I was autistic. And I read about the double empathy problem, which is that autistic people can only empathize with other autistic people, and neurotypical people can like empathize with neurotypicals but not autistic people. So that's why the original autism diagnosis said that autistic people lacked empathy, when it's actually not true. It's just that we can empathize with the autistic experience better than we ever could. Like, we can only cognitively empathize, so we can think about, but we can't like effectively empathize and say, oh, I can put myself in your shoes, because we're just distinctly autistic. So I think in my school and being a TA and teacher and my whole career, really, I've always had that, empathy light bulb that kind of goes off, where I think you must be autistic too, because only I would think like that. And I sit there listening to a child and it does go off. But I think, there's a lot of arguments about how broad the spectrum really is. And I think there's a lot of people who would never meet the criteria for a diagnosis and may never need to, because they are perfectly happy in this world. And I think the fight that I'm trying to explain, because I heavily, heavily mask, is that people like me do require support, because when we're not masking, we have much higher needs than you could imagine.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, well said. I'm just hearing your words and I'm grinning because these words really resonate with me, and I'm just hoping they resonate with the audience because I just don't think that we talk about these things openly enough. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, I think it's a big topic in education at the moment, but I don't think it's one in society, unfortunately. And it's funny because it seems to, I encounter this problem everywhere I go, where it's like people seem to think that suddenly at 18 you magically lose like everything that your diagnosis brought about in terms of difficulties in your life. Like, there's a magic switch that goes off of, you're an adult now, you must be able to deal with all the things you couldn't before suddenly. So I think the education system is definitely doing a lot, and then elsewhere there's very little and very little discussion around it.
Okay, no, that's okay. I'm glad we delved into that because I've learned a lot there, and I've identified with a lot of the things that you said. And I'm just hoping that it does improve over the years, especially with teachers, like you know, who have got the interest and the drive to sort of like try and make things better. So yeah, good luck with that.
Thank you.
And so in terms of spoken word now, do you have sort of like any sort of like goals or sort of like things that you want to achieve in this space? Because I just think something like this. Oh yeah, in fact, before you carry on, before we go into that, can you just explain what spoken word is?
It's just spoken words, it's poetry, it's prose, it's whatever resonates that like your soul is telling you to write and share, really. So it's a beautiful thing. And I think in terms of my goals, I am in a spoken word theatre company. We will have a play later on this year. I think we've got a scratch play this month, and then we've got one in September. So that's a big part of my journey, is to just explore. I always used to describe myself on stage as a page poet, and people used to get incredibly annoyed at me for always saying that, because they said you should perform, people need to hear you. And I think having this theatre company and the acting coaching and all the other stuff is really allowing me to explore that voice and like how I want people to hear my words. So I think as much as I wanted to be a published author, and I think I still will aspire to that, I'm mostly focusing on performance at the moment.
Right. So when you say a page, what does that mean? I didn't understand that. A page author,
Yeah,
you say.
a page poet, a published author.
Oh, right. Got it. Got it. Okay. Got it. Okay. So is this, so they said that's what you were, but you but then obviously coming out and doing the spoken word is allowing you to perform
Yeah,
those.
you're no longer a page poet, you're now a stage poet.
Ah, right. So you're a page poet. Okay, got it. And then there's a difference between that and a stage poet, yeah. And you
Yeah.
like that obviously the stage poet is the way you want to be.
For now, but I love both. I just think my book's not been written yet.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so if you wanted to sort of like encourage someone to sort of like do an open mic or, sort of express some of the things that they're writing, what would you suggest to them?
Just to like spend some time alone with your thoughts and listen to what they have to say. Because I think we spend so much time listening to other people that we do forget to listen to ourselves. And I think writing is a massive, massive way to connect with yourself. So that would be the best thing to do.
Yeah. And actually getting up there and performing, what would you say to that?
Just do it. I think once you've done it once, it's never scary, wouldn't you agree, Reggie?
Yeah. Well, as I said, I did my spoken word a few nights ago, and it was for me, it was an out of body experience. I was so nervous, but I was so glad that I did it. I'm still buzzing from it. So I would suggest just do it. And one thing I would say, especially with the right to speak organization, and most probably open mics, I don't know, you've been to more than I have, they're quite encouraging, aren't they? And they're quite
Yeah, they're
forgiving as
very
well, aren't they?
supportive environments for
Supportive,
sure.
yeah.
Yeah, they're very supportive environments.
Yeah. So I would say that if you're thinking about it, say get your words ready. And for me, I read it straight from my page. Some people go up there and just read it. They memorize it, but I read it from my page, and so I just knew that it was there, and I wasn't going to get caught out and stuff like that. So I think that's what I would say to people if you're going to do it for the first time. But if you can read it without reading from a book or anything like that, then do it. But if you're for your first time, you're going to get nervous, then I would say read it from a book. I'm not sure what you'd say about that.
Interestingly, I didn't have a choice because I was on crutches when I did my very first open mic. So I did memorize mine just because I didn't have any hands to hold anything with. So since then, however, I'm definitely a big fan of a notebook. I think tonight's performance that I'm doing, because it's going to be very heartfelt, a lot of like confessions and letters and emotional. So I think I will be reading. So it's just whatever feels right. I don't think there's any status with these things necessarily. It's just about getting the message out.
Exactly. It's all about the words, all about the words and the message. Well, I tell you what, Mari, thank you very much for coming on the podcast and telling us about your journey of spoken word and your challenges as well. And as I say, good luck with the future with the teaching, good luck with the future with your performing in your spoken word, and I'm sure we'll see each other again very soon.